Content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Woodward for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from The Week magazine, the best of the U.S. and international media each week. Today's program is generously underwritten by W.G. Alexander. At W.G. Alexander and Associates, they take pride in providing clients with the best legal counsel by concentrating on elder law, asset protection, and estate planning. They can be contacted at 919-256-7000. We're reading this week from the August 7th, 2020 issue of The Week magazine. The cover drawing this week shows in the foreground there are three people. In the middle is a woman with a Black Lives Matter t-shirt. She's wearing a face mask. She's got a little bloody spot on her forehead. And on either side of her, holding her arms, taking her away, are policemen. They're in full, like, war combat camouflage with helmets and face masks. In the background behind the three is a rioting scene. You can see fire and both police and protesters. The title today is Sound and Fury. Were federal agents sent to Portland to quell violence or to incite it? And we'll start with that topic in our first main story. Portland protesters and agents in violent clashes. What happened? After a week of escalating confrontations between protesters and federal agents outside a federal courthouse in Portland, Oregon, Governor Kate Brown said this week that the Department of Homeland Security has agreed to a phased withdrawal of its officers. Acting DHS Secretary Chad Wolf cautioned, however, that any pullback was contingent on significant improvement in the security situation in the city, where protesters' numbers have swelled over the past week in opposition to the federal presence. His point was underlined by President Trump, who said he was ready to send up to 75,000 federal agents into Democratic-led cities he painted as bastions of lawlessness. "We're not leaving until they've secured their city," he said of Portland. "If they don't, we're going to have to go in and clean it out." While thousands of Black Lives Matter demonstrators have gathered peacefully in Portland by day, at night the scene at the courthouse has grown tense and violent, with activists throwing rocks and cans, launching fireworks, and setting fires while agents emerge to fire tear gas, stun grenades, and rubber bullets. Portland Mayor Ted Wheeler, who was tear-gassed when he joined the demonstrators, called the agents in riot gear an occupying force and blamed them for intensifying the protests. Demonstrations spurred by the Portland standoff spread across the U.S. over the weekend, with police and protesters clashing in Los Angeles, Chicago, Richmond, Virginia, and Aurora, Colorado. In Seattle, police used pepper spray and flash grenades to clear some 2,000 protesters galvanized by the presence of a federal agent sent into the city to quell anticipated violence. Seattle Mayor Jenny Durkin, one of six mayors who called on Congress on Monday to bar the use of federal troops in cities that haven't requested them, called the use of paramilitary-type forces in the U.S. cities textbook despotism. What the editorial said: Trump's incursion into Portland is an act of stunning overreach, said the Seattle Times. Protecting the federal courthouse is defensible, but sending agents into city streets to use brutal tactics veers into dystopian governance. The Department of Homeland Security has no role using force within an American city where it's not wanted. The militarized intervention is a blatant political power play, said the Boston Globe. To boost his troubled reelection bid, Trump is trying to tap the same fear-mongering and racialized appeal that helped get him elected in 2016. If Democratic mayors don't like what's happening in Portland, they should get off their duffs and start governing, said WashingtonExaminer.com. The so-called peaceful protesters have inflicted millions in property damage, set the police union headquarters on fire, laid siege to a courthouse, and fired on-law officers with slingshots and air rifles. If ineffectual local officials desperate to placate the anti-police mob won't crack down on these anarchist rioters, someone else must. What the columnist said. For Trump, Portland has been a roaring success, said David Graham in TheAtlantic.com. Needing a distraction from his disastrous pandemic performance, Trump barely concealed his goal. Send federal forces into unwilling Democratic cities, wait for images of conflict, and then use it as both retroactive justification and political leverage for his reelection campaign. The tit-for-tat violence that's escalated over the past week would represent a dismal failure if the goal was to quell unrest, but it never was. Trump aimed to stoke it. The stormtrooper comparisons are absurd, said Rich Lowry in NationalReview.com. The federal deployment in Portland is plainly legal, justified, and proportionate. The agent's right to protect federal property from a violent mob is unquestionable. The off-site arrests, seized on by hyperventilating critics as rogue abductions, were prudent police work. To wade into a crowd to arrest a lawbreaker is to invite danger. This is authoritarianism 101, said Trudy Rubin in the Philadelphia Inquirer. Despots stoke violence and civil strife to scare their people into supporting leaders who would protect them. When faced with peaceful protesters, they provoke chaos as an excuse to unleash their own violence. I've seen this strongman's playbook in operation around the globe, from Syria and Egypt to Russia and Hong Kong, but I never expected to see it unfold in America. Our controversy of the week is titled Homeschooling. Are pandemic pods unethical? As school districts give uncertain signals about the fall, anxious parents are taking matters into their own hands, said Patrick Hoff in Spectator.us. Homeschooling was once limited largely to evangelical Christians and off-the-grid hippies. But many mainstream parents are starting to see it as a better choice than having their children educated remotely via ineffective online Zoom classes or sending them into public schools that could be hotbeds of coronavirus. Parents also have to work, of course, so many families are organizing pandemic pods of between 5 and 10 children each, where the parents either take turns teaching lesson or pool their resources to hire a full-time tutor. There are obvious benefits to podding, said Juliana Kaplan in BusinessInsider.com. Children get the socialization benefits of mingling with peers, while families minimize their risk of infection. But critics say pods will only widen the already deep chasm of educational inequities in America, as mostly white upper-middle-class families use their money to hire the best teachers, while further draining students and resources from a public school system the pandemic has already brought to its knees. Pandemic pods may be new, said Valerie Strauss in the Washington Post, but they're just another form of white flight from public education. Pods will have a disastrous impact on minority students, even if organized by well-meaning liberals who only weeks ago put up Black Lives Matter signs in their yards and windows. Parents are naturally going to team up with people they know and trust, said Clara Totenberg Green in the New York Times. This rational impulse will lead affluent white families to pod together and exclude many Black and Latino families. The result will be a society that's more stratified and more deeply riven by racial inequities rooted in white supremacy. Spare us the triple helping of guilt, said Matt Welch in Reason.com. Parents aren't starting pods to separate their children from people who don't look like them. They're starting pods because there's no guarantee that schools will reopen, and because they would rather eat razor blades than spend another school year trying to do their jobs in a home full of bored, restless, noisy children. If progressives are scared that pods will widen inequality, said Bethany Mandel in WashingtonExaminer.com, maybe they should reconsider their long-standing opposition to so-called voucher systems. Why not give education funds to all families directly and allow that money to follow those children to pods, tutors, or private schools that choose to open? That might be a long-term solution, said Josh Greenman in the New York Daily News. But with the coming school year just weeks away, all parents are going to do what's in their children's best interest. And some parents simply have more resources to advance those interests than others. Wealthy parents should channel their well-founded guilt into finding new ways to give low-income families access to the same alternative. Pods are a short-term solution for a lucky few, said Helene Olin in the Washington Post. In the long term, though, the fragmentation of our schooling system is going to worsen the plight of everyone. Any society that forces parents to figure out schooling on their own is a failing one. It was a good week for the way we were. With the announcement that former heavyweight champion Mike Tyson, 54, will fight former heavyweight champion Roy Jones Jr., 51, in a September pay-per-view exhibition match. Just because they're over 50, Tyson said, doesn't mean our lives are totally over. It was a good week for adaptation after a strip club in Houston reinvented itself as a drive-through service. Socially distanced dancers at the Vivid Gentlemen's Club perform on a tented stretch of sidewalk behind metal barriers, and customers are asked to drive on after only two songs. And it was a good week for getting that puppy, after new research found that children ages 2 to 5 are 40% less likely to have social interaction problems with other children if raised in a home with a family dog. But it was a bad week for curveballs after President Trump became jealous when health official Anthony Fauci threw out a first pitch at a baseball game and told reporters that he would do the same at Yankee Stadium, which came as news to the Yankees. Trump later tweeted that he canceled his first pitch because of my strong focus on the China virus. It was a bad week for size-ism. After Venice formally lowered from 6 to 5 the passenger limit on the city's iconic gondolas because of the increasing weight of the average tourist. Going forward with over half a ton of meat on board is dangerous, said gondolier Raul Rovarato. And finally, it was a bad week for David Hines, a Florida businessman accused of receiving $4 million in loans from the Paycheck Protection Program and using it for personal expenses, including buying a $318,000 Lamborghini. David is anxious to tell his side of the story, said his lawyer. And before we move on, there's a short news piece here. Defense bill scraps Confederate names and symbols. The Senate passed a $741 billion defense spending measure last week by a veto-proof 86-14 margin that would remove any Confederate names or symbols from military property within 3 years. The vote came just days after the Democratic-controlled House passed its own version of the annual National Defense Authorization Act, which would also require the renaming of Army bases. President Trump had vowed to veto the legislation, calling it an attempt to scrub U.S. history. Despite threats to veto it over policy issues, presidents have always signed the annual defense spending bill. Inhaling the Senate, inhaling the vote, Senator Tim Kaine, the Democrat from Virginia, said the U.S. cannot be serious about efforts at racial justice if it continues to honor those who tried to destroy our country to save slavery. Title of our briefing page article this week is School Kids and the Coronavirus. As schools and parents struggle with the decision to reopen in-person classes, what do we know about kids' vulnerability? Can children get COVID-19? Yes, but the evidence strongly suggests that children are less prone to infection by the coronavirus than adults. Those under 18 account for about 6% of the confirmed cases in the U.S., despite constituting some 22% of the population, according to data from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. That figure is somewhat higher than numbers from China, where children and teens accounted for 2.2% of confirmed cases, Italy 1.2%, and Spain 0.8%. A study published in Nature in June found that children and teenagers were about half as likely as adults to get infected by the virus. It seems, consistently, children do have lower rates of infection than adults, said Allison Tribble, a pediatric infectious disease expert at the University of Michigan. Some doctors, however, believe pediatric infections are significantly undercounted because they're often asymptomatic. New data from hard-hit states, including Arizona and Mississippi, have shown children accounting for some 10% of cases. Can children get seriously ill? In rare cases. But the Nature study found that among those between 10 and 19, only 21% showed any symptoms at all. Hospitalizations are rare among the young and deaths rarer still. As of July 22nd, the COVE Kid Project, COVKID, which tracks pediatric figures in the U.S., counted 77 deaths among the young from a total of more than 144,000 deaths overall, and just over 800 intensive care admissions. Over a three-month period ending in May, one study found only 44 deaths among children and teenagers across France, Germany, Italy, South Korea, Spain, the UK, and the US. During that period, there were 13,000 pediatric deaths from normal causes. A small number of children who've contracted COVID have been afflicted with multisystem inflammatory syndrome in children, or MIS-C, an immune response that causes severe inflammation throughout the body, attacking the blood vessels, heart, kidneys, and other organs. The New England Journal of Medicine counted approximately 1,000 victims worldwide, with a median age of 8. Why are children less vulnerable? It's a huge puzzle, said Nicholas Davies, an epidemiologist at the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine. But there are several theories. One is that children's cells have fewer of the ACE2 receptors the coronavirus latches onto in order to launch an infection. Another theory is that since kids are frequently infected with the relatively benign coronaviruses that cause common colds, those infections generate a level of cross-immunity to the new coronavirus. The many immunizations children get may have a similar spillover protective effect. Yet another possibility is that children's immune systems are simply stronger and better suited to fighting the virus in ways that aren't clear. And some hypothesize that children are better equipped to fight off novel pathogens as they're constantly called on to do it. Everything an infant sees or a young child sees is new, said Donna Farber, an immunologist at Columbia University. Can children infect others? This is the million-dollar question. Numerous studies from Europe and Asia have suggested children pass the disease on to others at a lower rate than adults. In a study of 39 Swiss households infected with COVID, children were suspected of having been the source in only three. In a French study, an infected boy exposed more than 80 classmates to the virus, and none contracted it. The data are striking, pediatric disease specialist William Raska wrote in the Journal of Pediatrics in July, citing these studies and three others. The key takeaway is that children are not driving the pandemic, but age seems to be a key factor. A new large-scale study from South Korea found a significant difference between children under 10 and teens. What is the difference? The study confirmed that younger children are significantly less likely to spread the virus, but found those between 10 and 19 transmit the virus at similar rates to adults. That lines up with evidence offered by reopened schools in Israel, New Zealand, and France, where the largest outbreaks have been in middle and high schools. A study of French schools by a scientist at the Pasteur Institute in Paris found that the risk of infection was much greater in high schools than in elementary schools. We need to make sure to differentiate between young and older children, said Alyssa Balinski, a Harvard doctoral student who's studying school outbreaks. By the time you reach high school, the risk of infection is pretty indistinguishable from young adults. And even if young children have a much lower risk of infection and transmission, experts warn, there will be inevitably some outbreaks in schools. Kids are not a bubbled population, said Michael Osterholm, an infectious disease expert at the University of Minnesota. There will be transmission in schools, and we have to include that in our plans. Moving on to our best columns, we'll start with one from the U.S. The title is Disinfecting Surfaces is Hygiene Theater. As a COVID-19 summer surge sweeps the country, deep cleans are all the rage, said Derek Thompson. Restaurants, gyms, offices, and mass transit are all trying to create public confidence by spraying oceans of disinfectants on every square inch of America's surface area. Sorry, but this may all be a huge waste of time, a piece of hygiene theater with no practical purpose. Scientists studying how coronavirus has spread have concluded that surface transmission is extremely rare. Instead, they have traced nearly all outbreaks to airborne respiratory droplets spread from person to person, large droplets expelled in sneezes and coughs, and smaller aerosolized droplets from speech or even exhalations, which can linger in the air of indoor spaces. In real-world conditions, scientists say, the virus does not survive on surfaces for very long. We should all still wash our hands when out in public, but studies have concluded that people aren't getting infected from packages, elevator buttons, or door handles. It's wearing masks, distancing, and moving activities outdoors that actually keep us safe. Theatrically blasting surfaces with disinfectants builds a false sense of security in indoor spaces, which can ironically lead to more infections. This is from the UK. Scotland would fare better alone. Britain's coronavirus debacle is driving ever more Scots to embrace independence, said Adam Ramsey. When Scotland held its independence referendum in 2014, 55% voted to remain part of the UK. Now, 54% of Scottish voters back secession, up 5 percentage points since spring. Discontent was growing even before the pandemic. Scots were strongly against Brexit, and many clung to the idea of a second European referendum. That hope was the final branch keeping them in the unionist tree. And when Britain left the European Union in January, it snapped. Then the coronavirus struck and Scotland's lack of control over its own affairs became lethal. Scotland's First Minister, Nicola Sturgeon, has been open, honest, and caring. A welcome contrast to Prime Minister Boris Johnson's blustering and fumbling. But while Scotland's lockdown was stricter than England's, we couldn't start it as early as Sturgeon wanted, because we didn't have our own treasury to pay furloughed workers. London holds the purse strings. The coronavirus death rate is lower in Scotland than in England, but it's hard not to look to our safer still nearest neighbors, Ireland and Norway, and wonder where we'd be if we, too, were independent of the failing British state. This is a How They See Us International column. A point of no return with China. The Trump administration, a group of political madmen, wants a Cold War with China, said the Global Times from China in an editorial. U.S. law enforcement broke into the Chinese consulate in Houston last week, blatantly violating international diplomatic conventions. Accusing China of using the consulate as a base for espionage and influence operations, but providing no evidence to back up its claims, the U.S. ordered the outpost closed. It was just the latest in a string of provocations from Washington, including hundreds of billions of dollars in tariffs slapped on Chinese goods, a ban on our tech giants, and unfounded claims of human rights abuses. China has never struck first, but has only taken countermeasures, standing on the right side of international justice. It wants neither a cold war nor a hot one. But if Washington is determined to blow up diplomatic ties, accidental sparks may lead to unprecedented catastrophe. Sinking in the polls, U.S. President Donald Trump is desperate to distract voters from blaming him for the social and economic carnage wrought by the pandemic and his own abject failure to contain it, said Yodan Latu in the South China Morning Post. China is the fall guy. Trump's thuggish top diplomat, U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, made an unhinged rant of a speech last week that was beyond appalling in its ignorance and xenophobia. He painted China as a land of enslaved people who hate their evil leaders, when in fact a Harvard University poll found that 93% of Chinese are satisfied with their government, compared with a meager 38% of Americans. America's allies won't join this new Cold War, said Gwen Dyer in the Toronto Star. They agree that China is a nasty, corrupt dictatorship, intolerant of dissent and oppressive toward its minorities. But Beijing is territorially expansionist only in its own neighborhood. So Pompeo's claim that China is the central threat of our times is a joke. America's partners are just waiting for Trump to be voted out. Britain, for example, has ostensibly bowed to U.S. pressure and agreed to bar Chinese telecom Huawei from its 5G network. Actually, British officials whispered in Huawei's ear that all was not lost and that they might reconsider next year. Unspoken was that the White House could well have a new occupant in 2021. China can wait, said Zhu Hequeng in KaixinGlobal.com from China. We have already shown patience, waiting 72 hours at the closure of the Houston consulate before shutting the U.S. consulate in Chengdu. Chinese policymakers are cool-headed and have long-term vision in the face of the present turbulence. They support continued engagement with the U.S. Still, we can't assume that all these tensions will simply blow over, said Shi Jiayu and Liu Liangxi, also in KaixinGlobal.com. The Trump administration could do real damage to our economy if it follows the advice of hawks in Washington and attempts to cut China off from the international dollar payments system. Instead of blindly hoping for the best, China should plan ahead. The last word, our in-depth article, takes us down a slightly different road this week. I think I'm ready for a little change of pace. The title is The Great American Canned Corn Robbery. Teams of thieves cruise U.S. highways, brazenly grabbing entire truck trailers full of goods, said Dylan Taylor Lehman in Narratively.com. Just about anything that can be trucked can be stolen and sold. On May 11, 2013, a semi-cab made its way up Interstate 555 from Memphis, northwest to Jonesboro, Arkansas. The man driving, a career trucker from Memphis, was accompanied by his nephew, and the pair were bobtailing, meaning their truck wasn't pulling a trailer. Drivers often have to travel between warehouses and shipping facilities to pick up a new load, and these two men were indeed in search of new cargo to haul. Only in this case, they weren't looking to do it legally. They were cruising the truck stops along I-555 for unattended trailers to pick up and steal. Truckers sometimes leave their trailers at truck stops or even in parking lots in order to visit a mechanic or drive the cab home for the weekend. So the men knew it was only a matter of time before they came across an unattached trailer, overlooked in the bustle of a busy truck stop. The pair's combined experience came in handy, as either one of them could hook up to a trailer, crank up the landing gear, and connect a few hoses, then drive right off in a matter of minutes. At around 5:40 p.m., the men found what they were looking for, a 52-foot Wabash trailer sitting in the parking lot of the Snappy Mart truck stop in West Plains, Missouri. The nephew dropped out of the cab and ran over to the trailer, directing as his uncle backed up. They maneuvered the large U-shaped coupling on the back of the tractor under the trailer's enormous kingpin, which clanked into place and locked automatically. The nephew hopped up and walked through the space between the tractor and the trailer to connect a few hoses and cables. The two men drove off with the errant trailer, itself worth $7,500, even empty, and hightailed it with whatever cargo was inside, intensely vigilant but giddy like kids at a criminal Christmas. They drove up through Chicago and into Indiana before cutting northward into Michigan in the early morning of May 12th. The distance was substantial, but not especially noteworthy for long-haul truckers who crisscrossed the U.S. highway system on a weekly basis. The pair already had buyers set up in obscure warehouse locales, people who knew how to efficiently get rid of bulk goods. The men would get a cut of the proceeds. As they would later find out, their prize haul was $30,000 worth of Green Giant canned corn, headed from a food processing facility in Montgomery, Minnesota, to a food pantry in Little Rock, Arkansas. The 40,000 cans of corn weighed many thousands of pounds. Would they have gone through with the theft if they had known what the trailer contained? Surprisingly enough, yes. A trailer full of canned corn isn't a bust of a heist. Cheap food disappears easily into mom-and-pop shops, swap meets, and over-the-counter, over-the-internet, and it's virtually untraceable once it's gone. If you have enough of something and you can sell it for cheap enough, you can make it disappear very quickly, and your profit is 100%, said Manteca Police Department Sergeant Joe Ahuna, who has worked on cargo theft cases in California's Central Valley region. In fact, some of the highest value and thus most targeted loads in recent years have been snack nuts. When a drought greatly diminished the supply of nuts, thereby raising the demand for them, seasoned truck thieves became more interested in going after nuts than they were big-ticket electronics or medicine. Nut theft reached a peak in early 2015, with 31 nut heists costing carriers more than $5 million. How are you to track individual nuts, said Sergeant Shauna Pacheco, a supervisor in the California Highway Patrol's Golden Gate Investigative Services Unit and a member of its cargo theft interdiction program. When those nuts get transported to a warehouse where they are processed, some are legal and some are stolen, but all are crushed and bagged, so good luck telling the difference. Similar networks of licit and illicit buyers are relied on to fence everything from lunch meat to designer clothes. And the same strategy is at play today in the midst of the coronavirus pandemic. Sheriffs in North Carolina recently tracked down a stolen semi carrying 18,000 pounds of toilet paper. The two truck thieves, Earl Stanley Nunn and his nephew Michael Lee Shirley, were no slouches when it came to ripping off trucks. The crew they were working with had previously conducted similar operations in more than a dozen states, spreading the felonies across countless jurisdictions. What they didn't know was that they were already being carefully tracked by the FBI's Memphis Cargo Theft Task Force, which had placed a GPS tracking device on Nunn's tractor. The canned corn thieves made their way across Michigan on Interstate 94. Their route took them across Jackson County in the southeastern part of Michigan's Mitten. As they drove, the marshals contacted the Michigan Department of State Police's Southwest Commercial Auto Recovery, SCAR unit, to let them know they had a stolen load coming their way. The SCAR team was already aware of Nunn, whom authorities had been keeping an eye on since 2009, but they'd ramped up surveillance a year earlier after his son Roderick had been arrested for stealing a trailer full of 39,000 pounds of Wrigley's gum, valued at $175,000, from a shipping facility and attempting to drive it to Detroit, a heist that led to a 15-minute chase with a Michigan State police officer and culminated in Roderick running from the cab and his co-conspirator attempting to hide in a field. The younger Nunn had also been convicted of bank robbery in 2002 and of stealing $92,000 worth of sugar and powdered lemonade mix in 2008. Nunn and Shirley didn't hear the siren at first. It only intruded on their consciousness when they saw the emergency lights of a Michigan State Police vehicle in their rearview mirrors. Hoping it could talk his way out of the stop, Nunn slowed down and coasted onto the shoulder, stopping right between mile markers 141 and 142. It was 7 in the morning, and they were approximately 80 miles from their presumed destination in Detroit. The officer took his time exiting his vehicle, taking notes but deliberately delaying contact to intimidate the drivers. He ambled up to the cab and asked for the driver and the passenger to get out. The officer asked Nunn where he got the trailer. "We picked it up just outside of Gary, Indiana," Nunn said. "A guy named Charlie told us to grab it from the Blue Ox truck stop. He claimed they were to be paid $1,000 for the trip, that there was no paperwork associated with the load, and that was all he knew." The arrest was uneventful. Nunn and Shirley were taken to Jackson, Michigan, and questioned again by detectives. Shirley said he'd just been along for the ride, while Nunn said he was starting to worry a bit about his own safety, since the load hadn't been delivered to Charlie. The detectives listened with inscrutable expressions before they revealed that they had been tracking Nunn's tractor across four states. They knew Charlie wasn't real, as they'd been watching Nunn for almost a year, including every step of his most recent escapade. The trailer was towed to a nearby storage facility in Michigan, and the agents worked on getting the load back to its intended recipient. A manager with a Missouri-based shipping company who organized the delivery was stunned after speaking to authorities. She hadn't even known that the load was missing, and now she was being told it had been recovered more than 700 miles away. Whether it's loads of canned corn or construction materials or 25,000 cell phones, truck thievery is surprisingly common. CargoNet, an industry group that tracks cargo theft, tallied roughly 2,600 truck thefts in 2019, with the average value of a trailer theft at around $148,000. Truck hijacking has, of course, been going on as long as there have been trucks. And before that, train and stagecoach robberies emerged as an indispensable part of American folklore. The phenomenon became particularly widespread during Prohibition, when gangsters would jack trucks to fund booze-running operations and other crimes. Today, outright hijacking of trucks is fairly rare in the United States, and when it does happen, it doesn't require a Fast and Furious-style, tech-filled sports car hanging from a helicopter. Most important is the element of surprise. Overwhelm the driver, toss him out of the vehicle, and drive off. The same now as it was in the 1930s. But most truck thieves avoid the muss and fuss of violence or kidnapping, preferring instead to take an unattended trailer. Thieves look for victims on internet hauling boards such as truckstop.com, where truckers often piece together deliveries for different companies, one on the way to a destination, a different one on the way back. Thieves troll these boards and can home in on a shipment that looks promising. The job boards don't mention any specifics about a haul, sales and logistics specialist Arthur Schwartzer said, but an enterprising thief likely knows how to call a shipper and obtain specifics without raising any suspicions. They can use this information and doctored paperwork to pick up a load before anyone is the wiser. Alternately, the thieves sometimes pretend to be the truck crew legitimately scheduled to pick up the load and simply beat the real drivers to the punch. A shipment's bill of lading, a critical piece of paperwork for any legitimate delivery, describing the weight, contents, and tracking number of a shipment, can be faked with information obtained by skilled social engineers. But the most common method of jacking a truck is generally the most banal. Thieves know where to look for unattended trailers. At truck stops, it's open season, with trailers galore for the taking, especially if you've got a seasoned crew. In recent years, a 12-member Louisville-based outfit operated a complex cargo thievery network across more than 10 states. They would conduct surveillance on facilities shipping high-value goods, then follow departing trucks until they stopped for gas, at which time the trailer would be stolen, driven miles away, hooked up to a different tractor, and taken back to Louisville to be sold off. The group took everything from cigarettes to appliances to baby formula, as well as a load of thousands of cell phones, a single shipment valued at almost $12 million. All told, the group stole $30 million worth of cargo from 2012 to 2015. But the high-value cell phone heist proved to be their undoing. An FBI-led task force injected false intel into the group in the form of another shipment of cell phones leaving Louisville. "We knew they were going to be watching the facility in Louisville," said FBI Special Agent Paul Meyer. "They took the bait. We watched them steal the load, and then we took them down." In May 2018, the men were sentenced to between 1 and 12.5 years for their crimes. Earl Stanley Nunn's operations were modest in comparison, but that didn't mean the law wouldn't come down on him with equivalent force. Nunn appeared in court in Missouri in September 2014. He was sentenced to 10 years in prison, the maximum possible, in order to pay more than $3.5 million in restitution to the businesses he was convicted of ripping off. His trucking business was dismantled, and any salvageable assets, such as the truck used in the heist, were seized. His nephew, Michael Lee Shirley, got 4.5 years for the corn theft and for breaking his parole on an unrelated prior conviction. He was released in 2017. Roderick Nunn, the driver's son, was named as a co-conspirator in the canned corn heist. He simultaneously faced charges related to the Wrigley's gum heist, which had led authorities to track his father's truck to begin with, plus additional charges for nabbing 8 other trucks between 2006 and 2012, with hauls that included microwaves, Freon, beauty products, and computers. The FBI noted hundreds of thousands of dollars moving in and out of Roderick Nunn's and his girlfriend's bank accounts during the same period, which agents figured to be the couple's cut of the proceeds. Based on the estimated 10% a driver would receive, the FBI extrapolated that the total value of Nunn's trailer thefts was likely in the realm of $8 million. Roderick Nunn was sentenced to 6.5 years in prison for the Wrigley's heist. He has since been paroled. This was adapted from an article originally published in Narratively.com. Got another high-profile obituary for you this week. The excitable, cantankerous host who livened up morning TV, Regis Philbin, 1931 to 2020. Regis Philbin greeted millions of Americans every weekday morning for 33 years, usually with a new indignity to vent about. Horrible traffic, the Mets, those damn computers. His griping proved endearing, even if an exasperated Kathy Lee Gifford had to cut him off with, "Oh, Reg." As co-host of ABC's Live, beginning with Gifford in 1988, and later with Kelly Ripa, Philbin thrived in the unscripted, unrehearsed format, especially the first 20 minutes of riffing and playful barb trading. He also hosted ABC's smash hit game show, Who Wants to Be a Millionaire?, from 1999 to 2002, sending shockwaves of self-doubt with his catchphrase, "Is that your final answer?" By the time he retired from Live in 2011, Philbin had logged nearly 17,000 hours in front of TV cameras, a Guinness World Record. "Every day you see the record shattered, pal," Philbin would tell viewers, "one more hour." Born to Italian-Irish parents in the Bronx, New York, he was named Regis for the Roman Catholic boys' high school his dad attended, said the Associated Press. Philbin earned a degree in sociology at the University of Notre Dame, then spent 2 years in the Navy as a supply officer. On his last day in the service, said NPR.org, Philbin was asked by a major in the Marines what he wanted to do with the rest of his life. "I told him, what I'd like to do is go into television, but I don't know if I have any talent," he later recalled. The major barked that he should follow his dreams anyway, and Philbin returned to New York to work as an NBC page. 6 weeks later, he was hired as a stagehand in Los Angeles and climbed the TV ranks, landing his own local program, The Regis Philbin Show, in 1964. It was canceled after 8 episodes. His first prolonged national exposure came in 1967, said the Los Angeles Times, when ABC hired Philbin as announcer and sidekick on the Joey Bishop Show. That went off air 2 years later, and after bouncing around other shows, Philbin returned to New York in 1983 to co-host ABC's local morning show. His big break came in 1985, when Kathy Lee, the soon-to-be wife of NFL legend Frank Gifford, joined as co-host, leading to national syndication. Up against heavily produced, gossipy talk shows Live focused on smaller things, like visits from your mother-in-law or the kids bringing home stray cats, Philbin said in 1988. People relate to that. Celebrities also stopped by, said the New York Times, and Philbin would dance with the Chippendales or catch passes from Joe Namath. Despite his fame, Philbin had to lobby for the millionaire gig. On The Late Show, where he was David Letterman's most frequent guest, Philbin pledged that if he got the job, I am going to resurrect ABC. He did his bit. The British game show import generated $1 billion over the first 2 years, and an astonishing 30 million viewers tuned in three nights a week. At age 80, Philbin finally retired from live. There are times when I really miss it, he said of hosting. I just figured it was time to let go. And we'll turn on over to the talking points page to finish out the show. Start with MLB's outbreak. Will it shut down sports? The joy of baseball's return lasted just 4 days, said Thomas Boswell in WashingtonPost.com. 15 Miami Marlins players and two coaches tested positive for COVID-19 this week, forcing Major League Baseball to suspend Miami's season and cancel a host of games. The outbreak not only endangered the entire baseball season, but also shattered the naive assumption underlying all sports plans to reopen. If a virus hits a team, it would infect one or two players, maybe three. Now it's clear that COVID-19 can run through a team like wildfire. I'm scared. I really am, admitted Washington Nationals manager Dave Martinez, 55, who has a heart condition and already lost star player Juan Soto to a positive test. If baseball, socially distant by nature, can't work, professional and college football are never going to happen. So far, MLB owners have opted against canceling the season, said Helene Elliott in the Los Angeles Times, instead reminding players not to spit or share high fives and then hoping for the best. If it wasn't clear before this outbreak, it now is. Money is driving this madness, with the health of players, coaches, and their families a distant second. Perhaps the NHL and NBA will fare better, since they will resume this week with heavily tested players living and playing inside containment bubbles. Hockey's in Canada, basketball's at Disney World in Orlando. The NFL faces a much tougher challenge, said Gentry Estes in the Nashville Tennessean. It currently plans to have teams play home and away games and travel among cities, which greatly raises the risk that players will be infected in troublesome hotspots. The NFL should scrap its schedule and create hubs for teams in areas with low infection rates. With the pandemic still raging in the U.S., said Corbin Smith in NBCNews.com, it's irresponsible for baseball, football, and college football to be playing games, even without fans. But eventually the business interest won out, with President Trump and billionaire owners insisting on sending players back to perform for us. In fairness, said Bob Nightingale in USA Today, some players just wanted to compete again and offer the country an escape from all the grim news. And we've time for a few short pieces. We'll start with 32 police officers were fatally shot in the U.S. through July 13th, a 28% surge over the same period in 2019. Law enforcement officials say anti-police sentiment is playing a major part in the increase, which included seven officers who were killed in planned ambushes. White House health advisor Anthony Fauci said he's facing a growing number of serious threats to himself and his family, which has led to the government providing security. There are people who get really angry at thinking I'm interfering with their life because I'm pushing a public health agenda, Fauci said in an interview. I've seen a side of society that's a little bit disturbing. A multi-day revival event at an Alabama Baptist church has led to more than 40 coronavirus infections. The whole church has got it, just about, said Daryl Ross of Warrior Creek Missionary Baptist Church in Marshall County. He said attendees were not required to wear masks or remain distant. In the poll watch, 34% of Americans identify as conservative, down from a high of 40% in February. 26% identify as liberal, and 36% identify as moderate. An all-time high of 80% of Americans believe the country is headed in the wrong direction. A majority disapprove of how President Trump is handling the coronavirus pandemic, 68%. Education, 63%. Healthcare, 63%. And the economy, 51%. And we'll finish with a quote from George Orwell, quoted in New York Magazine, who says, "If liberty means anything at all, it means the right to tell people what they do not want to hear." And with that, we have run out of time for today's episode of the week. I hope you have enjoyed it. Be sure to listen again next time. This is Fred Woodward reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. Today's program is generously underwritten by W.G. Alexander. At W.G. Alexander & Associates, they take pride in providing clients with the best legal counsel by concentrating on elder law, asset protection, and estate planning. They can be contacted at 919-256-7000. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any questions or comments, please give us a call. That number is 919-832-5138.